Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future, titled Why Forests, Why Now? The Science, Economics, and Politics of Tropical Forests and Climate Change. Our speaker is Francis Seymour, Distinguished Senior Fellow at the World Resources Institute. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Pardee Center Associate Director Cynthia Barakat.
I'm delighted to introduce Francis Seymour, whose expertise is in the science, economics, and politics of tropical forest conservation and deforestation. She has a long and impressive resume. I promised her I would not take up too much of her talk time getting into the details, but there's just a couple of highlights I want to share with you. Her current position is she's a distinguished senior fellow at the World Resources Institute, where she previously worked in the late 90s and early 2000s as the director of the Institutions and Governance Program, a program which she established and is now called the Governance Center at WRI. She is a past director general of the Center for International Forestry Research in Indonesia, so she definitely knows what she's talking about here. And she currently serves and has served in the past as a consultant or advisor to several major foundations and NGOs who work on tropical forestry issues. She is regularly invited to speak on these issues at venues around the world, so we're delighted we got into her busy schedule today. So she's here today to talk about a book she co-authored that was published in 2016, called Why Forests, Why Now? The Science, Economics, and Politics of Tropical Forest and Climate Change. So without further ado, Francis.
What I'm going to do is base the presentation on the book. As you can see, it's, you know, more than 400 pages long, 13 chapters. You know, if we'd had more time, we would have written a shorter book. But it's a lot of content in here to peruse at your leisure. And what I'm going to do is just kind of go once over lightly to a lot of different topics, and then we can delve into what you're interested in during the discussion. These kinds of talks are really intimidating because with an audience like this, any particular topic that I touch on, there's bound to be somebody in the audience who knows more about it than I do. So we're going to be on the honor system here during the discussion. If you are one of those people, you out yourself and answer the question instead of having me do it. Okay, and I'm looking at you, Allison. So about the book, just for a minute. So this book was co-authored with Jonah Bush, who's a bright young ecologist economist. And together we collaborated to try to pull together the state of the science, the state of the economic analysis, and the state of political analysis on sort of what we know about tropical forests and climate change and development for a non-specialist audience. And the whole idea was to mobilize this content in a way that would be appealing to policymakers and break down the silos that we saw that separated forestry world, climate world, and development world. And so our aspiration was to come out with something that was authoritative yet accessible, that would help raise awareness of just how important tropical forests are. We felt that the book was needed because the field had moved forward so quickly over the last decade. There'd been so many advances, you know, across all these things. And so it was worth doing a book. But the bad news is that that change has continued at a rapid clip. So 1 year later, we already, you know, it's time for an update. So I'll try to sprinkle in some of the stuff that's happened since the book was published. I should say that in addition to the original analysis that Jonah and I did and the synthesis work, we also commissioned something like 20 papers from academics and others all over the landscape. And the background papers that went into the book are all posted on the Center for Global Development website. So if there's any particular thing you're interested in, what was the method that you guys used on the, you know, this time, it's all there. Okay, so starting out with why forests. Just to quickly pause on all the cool things that are in tropical forests that were often the entry point for many of us in getting interested in them before we dive into the policy wonkish world. The first of three key points that I will talk about in terms of the why forests, and in particular tropical forests, is that tropical deforestation is a major contributor to global climate emissions, but it's also reversing tropical deforestation and restoring forests is an even greater part of the climate solution. So just quick, you know, forests and climate change 101. Intact forests store a whole bunch of carbon, you know, some of the richest carbon stocks on the planet in tropical forests. When those forests are felled and burned, all that carbon is liberated into the atmosphere from geological time instantaneously. Often that leads to permanent conversion of that land to another use that continues to generate emissions, whether agricultural or industrial. But if left alone and the forests start growing back, they actively sequester carbon from the atmosphere, the only safe, natural, and proven carbon capture and storage technology that we currently have. And when we talk about the net fluxes of carbon between the land and the atmosphere, you take the gross carbon that's being released into the atmosphere in the deforestation process and subtract out the carbon that's being sequestered. And keep that in mind for a point later in the presentation. How big a problem is this? This is a huge problem. If tropical deforestation were its own country, it would rank third after China and the United States as a source of emissions. You know, nobody thinks we can solve the global climate change problem without dealing with China and the United States. We shouldn't think about solving it without tropical forests either. Big, big part of the problem. There's good news and bad news about the share of emissions from tropical deforestation in the global carbon budget. The good news is that the percentage share has been relatively constant over the last several decades. You see the orange stripe. The bad news is that the reason it's been relatively constant is that the denominator has been growing more quickly. In other words, the emissions from fossil fuels in that bottom wedge. And those trends have continued in recent years. Let me just point out one little thing here. You see the blip in 1997, 1998? That was when Indonesia's forest fires were raging, not for the first time and certainly not for the last time, but it shows that those forest fires are globally significant to climate emissions. One of the reasons that that blip occurred is that Indonesia is the home of a significant portion of the world's tropical peatlands. And as you may know, peatlands have particularly rich stores of carbon, most of it underground. You can see this in this orange box. It's like 18 times more carbon below the surface than is in the terrestrial vegetation above the surface. So when peatlands are disturbed and drained, and the organic matter that's been accumulating for sometimes thousands of years gets dried out, it becomes very flammable, and when it burns, goes up into the atmosphere as very thick haze with profound implications for public health, but also for the global climate. So it's really hard to see, but this is the island of Borneo in Southeast Asia, and this is what it looks like from space when the peatlands are burning. This particular cloud is over an area of central Kalimantan that was cleared and drained back at the end of the Suharto administration back in the 1990s. In a poorly thought out attempt to achieve rice self-sufficiency by planting rice in the swamplands. That land now burns chronically every dry season, and massive amounts of carbon emissions as well as the choking haze come out of it. In the fires that you probably read about towards the end of 2015, the daily emissions from Indonesia's fires exceeded the emissions from the entire United States economy on a daily basis. So again, globally significant emissions. Now, one of the reasons that people in climate world, I think, implicitly don't pay enough attention to land sector and particularly forest-related emissions is that the way the IPCC reports those emissions makes them look, and mitigation potential makes them misleadingly small. See, here's the stack of different sectors contributing to global net emissions, and you got electricity, industry, transport, and up there 8% global tropical net emission, global net emissions from tropical deforestation, 8%, less than 10%, not so much. But you got to remember that that wedge is a subtraction. Remember from the first slide, there's all that emissions from the deforestation, but then you have to subtract the amount that forests are taking out of the atmosphere. So it's a net number. But if we're talking about the mitigation potential of forests, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. we can reduce tropical deforestation and allow the damaged forest to grow back. Often they are in different places, and come up with a total, you know, theoretical potential mitigation from tropical forests of more like 24% to 30%. So a big part of the problem, but a significantly bigger part of the solution. Now, do you think tropical forests get anywhere near that share of political attention and finance? No. It's down to like, you know, 1% or 2%. So we really have a big gap to close between the potential and the amount of attention that it's getting now. My co-author, Jonah, did some modeling, combining various data sets and models about what it would cost if you had to compensate land users not to deforest, and how that mitigation cost compares to other emissions abatement potential, and came up with this cooler, cheaper, faster formulation that if we were to include tropical forests in global climate mitigation strategies, it would make the difference between overshooting and meeting the 2-degree target under the Paris Agreement. It could make the difference of being $100 billion a year cheaper to reach that target, or we could reach peak emissions more than 5 years sooner than we could otherwise. So again, another way to make the point that not only is this significant, but it's cost effective as a mitigation strategy. Okay, second point. Forests, I hope I've convinced you, are very important to the climate problem. But let's shift gears and talk about the relationship of tropical forests to the development challenge. So what do tropical forests have to do with development? Certainly, climate stability is an important part of achieving sustainable development goals. I mean, this is Hurricane Mitch bearing down on Central America. That is, we open our book by talking about the complex interlinkages between forests and hurricanes. But when a major storm like this hits a developing country, there's research that shows that basically it can knock the economy off its trajectory of income growth in ways that it doesn't recover for decades. So this is a significant threat to, you know, climate change is a significant threat to economic growth. And you can read the IPCC reports for all the reasons that poorer countries and poorer households are the most vulnerable to climate change. We have a very stylized diagram here where we focus on, you know, deforestation causes, you know, greenhouse gas emissions that influence climate change that cause poverty through those mechanisms. But of course, there's more direct relationships between deforestation and poverty that I'll talk about for a couple of minutes now. There are many invisible goods and services that tropical forests provide to the communities, both immediately adjacent to forests as well as those at greater distances. Here are just, you know, some examples from Africa, where in the Congo Basin in particular, bushmeat is a very important source of nutrition for communities that live in and around the forests, often fundamental source of proteins and fats for local communities. Fuel wood, probably, and charcoal, the most significant contributors to local income is access to the forest for fuel. Timber, in many places, the employment and income generated by artisanal timber for local construction, not even, you know, necessarily exported, is a very important source of local income. And often for women, collecting, processing, trading in non-timber forest products is a very important source of independent income for women. So all kinds of income, you know, in the household. You know, you say, oh yeah, but that's kind of trivial, you know. Actually, at the Center for International Forestry Research, a bunch of my colleagues did a really cool study where they exploited graduate students, essentially, to go out and use the same methodology to collect quarterly household survey information on how much income came from these kinds of activities, you know, products harvested from the wild. The answer was, from sites in 25 developing countries, on average, this kind of income constituted around 21% of household income from communities that lived in and around forests. 21%, you know, more than a fifth, so not trivial. And if you include income from other wild sources, non-forest, it's more like 27%. That's on a par with the amount they get from agriculture. And yet it's completely invisible in national accounts because nobody counts this stuff. A lot of it's, you know, not marketed, doesn't enter formal markets. So ignored and effectively given a value of zero when decisions to convert the forest to another use are made. Even more invisible are the ecosystem services that come from forests that are disproportionately important to the communities nearest by, but also have implications across landscapes and even continents. Local agricultural fields benefit from pollination services from the bats and the bees and the birds that live in the forest. Resilience, you know, natural vegetation protecting villages from landslides, or, you know, on the coast, the role of mangroves in attenuating waves, you know, just resilience. Hydropower, you know, quite a number of studies estimating the value of the services that forested watersheds provide in keeping sediment out of the reservoirs and extending their life, but also just providing continuous, you know, high quality and constant water to keep the turbines running. And then the newest science talks about how forests play a role in hydrology, not only at local levels, but increasingly at landscape, continental, or even transcontinental levels. Now, this science is above my pay grade, but some of the more recent articles, you know, talking about the biotic pump theory and the role of evapotranspiration and bringing rainfall across continents, so that, you know, the scary tipping point theories about if you deforest the Amazon beyond a certain point, it stops raining, you know, in the breadbasket areas of Brazil, really significant in terms of maintaining global agricultural productivity. This is just a stylized diagram that, you know, in the book, that's on the left, you know, all of the good things that we get for free from the forest in terms of, you know, goods and ecosystem services, and then all the disamenities like the landslides and the disease that come when those services are taken away. Again, linking back to the Sustainable Development Goals, you can pretty much do a one-to-one mapping among quite a number of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals related to hunger, related to income, related to safety, related to health, related to access to water, related to access to energy. And I would argue that if you do the 17x17 matrix of the Sustainable Development Goals, forests get you more hits than any of the other sectoral goals, but we could test that theory. Okay, last point about why forests. One could say, well, yeah, but tropical forests, mostly in developing countries, they have to be the ones to solve the problem, so, you know, what can we do? Well, actually, those of us in rich countries are a significant part of the problem, and so I will argue we have a responsibility also to help be part of the solution. This is not to say that developing countries aren't in the driver's seat. Obviously, they have to be the ones to make these decisions and take action, but we have a role to play here. So if you could see this, it would be a pile of very impressively sized tropical timber logs on their way to a port to be exported somewhere. This was kind of the face of tropical deforestation 20 years ago. You know, it was all about logging and exporting timber around the world. And it still is. It's still an issue in a number of places. But in many landscapes that are important, this is what deforestation looks like now. It is wholesale conversion of forests to commercial scale agriculture for globally traded commodities other than timber. So in Latin America, it is transforming cattle forests to cattle pastures to produce beef or to produce soybeans. In the area of the world I know best, which is Southeast Asia, it is converting forests to grow oil palm for palm oil, or to drain the peat swamps and plant fast-growing timber to feed the pulp and paper mills. So this is really what the face of deforestation looks like. Yes, there is some shifting cultivation of small farmers, you know, converting forests to croplands, but that is still a more minor part of the problem compared to these leading causes. And yeah, this is a from a study done by a guy named Sam Lawson for Forest Trends, and he estimated that of total the share of deforestation from 2000 to 2012 in the tropics, about 71% was for commercial agriculture, 49% was illegal by the definition of the countries involved at the time, and half of that was destined for international export markets. So a significant chunk, the highlighted in orange, of the conversion of forests for commercial agriculture is driven by export and is illegal. So interesting challenge. This was an analysis that we commissioned for the book from some academics in Sweden who put together various data sets to estimate how many carbon emissions were embodied in the flows of these commodities across continents. So if you do the math of, you know, multiplying how many hectares deforested by how many tons of carbon per hectare and how many, you know, tons of crude palm oil were produced with that over a 10-year period, you get these arrows. And so this is for the five main major commodities, pulp and paper, beef, timber, palm oil, soybeans. And the thickness of the arrow gives a sense of how many carbon emissions, you know, are going across continents. Two things to notice. One is that, see how thick the arrows are for beef in Brazil going off to Middle East or Russia or European Union? Actually, most beef in Brazil is consumed in Brazil. A very small piece is exported internationally, and yet you still get these ginormous thick arrows. So beef is kind of a big issue from a climate emissions point of view. Second thing to notice in the is that this is actually based on data from 2009. So almost a decade ago, and all of these arrows have gotten a lot fatter since then. Is it just because we are all enjoying our hamburgers and, you know, this is just our individual consumption patterns? No. Government policy actually makes this worse. One example has been the mandates and subsidies given to produce biofuels. And so this graph, done by a colleague of mine, Kim Elliott, at Center for Global Development, shows what happened to the consumption of biodiesel in the European Union after the EEC put into place a biodiesel policy directive to encourage that consumption. You can see it was a very successful policy that increased biodiesel consumption. This is done in the name of climate-friendly policies, by the way, right? Because this is supposed to be a climate-friendly fuel. And yet it also had the impact of increasing the imports of palm oil used for industrial purposes. And as we saw in the previous charts, you know, palm oil is one of the products cultivated at the expense of tropical forests in Malaysia and Indonesia, in some of the most carbon-dense ecosystems of the world. And, you know, by some estimates, if you were to use all of the palm oil to replace fossil fuels to get the increment of lower emissions, you would have to keep using them continuously for 800 years before you got back to carbon neutral because of all of the carbon emissions that were liberated in that initial forest conversion event. So probably not a particularly climate-friendly policy. So that's the why for us and why we should be involved in it. I hope I've convinced you. A couple quick updates, things that have happened since we published the book. Unfortunately, we are still losing. According to my colleagues at Global Forest Watch at World Resources Institute, based on data coming out of the University of Maryland, 2016 was a landmark year for global forest loss, representing a big uptick from the previous year and an increase in most of the major tropical forest countries. It was a year, as you know, we talked about, of forest fires all over the world. And so hopefully we'll see maybe a little decrease in 2017 when the numbers come out any day now, but probably not a lot. So this is not getting better. We're not making progress on this agenda. In the meantime, the scientific literature is proliferating. Not only several articles that are reinforcing and affirming our back of the envelope estimate about the about 30% of mitigation potential coming from forests. Some new articles that are piling on, sort of the post Paris. What are the pathways to get, you know, keep us to 2 degrees or 1.5? And all of them are coming in saying, yeah, you know, can't do it without the land sector. Global production and consumption of these forest risk commodities continue to increase. Politically, they're hot. You may have read in the newspaper that last year the European Parliament decided to ban biofuels based on vegetable oils, and this has caused a major diplomatic rupture with Indonesia and Malaysia, who are accusing the EU of protectionism, and it's a really big fight. So these are quite live issues as some of the policy levers are trying to be pulled to address this problem. Okay, why now? And this part'll be shorter so we can get to the discussion. Again, a quick pause to enjoy a forest. But of course, I hope I convinced you in the previous part that part of the why now is that you know, they're going fast. And there are, you know, the few pieces of real estate on the planet that have intact forests. They're increasingly looking like this. And one of the things we're appreciating more is the role of forest degradation, the sort of under canopy fires. I know it's a big deal in Brazil, that are leading to sort of more invisible climate emissions and forest destruction. But the first part, point I want to make here is that one of the reasons that we need to act on tropical deforestation is that actually Brazil has demonstrated that it's possible. For people like me who've spent the last several decades trying to, you know, do something about tropical deforestation, there's kind of a sense of despair. It's like, God, we've tried everything, you know, and nothing works, and it's hopeless, you know. But Brazil did it, okay? This is what happened to Brazil's deforestation rate in the decade since about 2004. I mean, this is an astonishing 75-80% decrease in the Amazonian deforestation rate. You know, back in the early part of this century, you know, we're up above 25,000 square kilometers per year of the Amazon, you know, going up in flames. You may remember this. Lawlessness, you know, murders, and it was just kind of a disaster, right? And then nobody predicted it, but all of a sudden, boom, went down. And people say, oh, well, that's because commodity prices were low and that, you know. Actually, commodity prices came back up and the soy and cattle production kept going there, and yet deforestation rate kept going down. So it's incredible proof of concept that you could decouple the production of these forest risk commodities from the deforestation rate. Some papers say, oh, well, did they spend a lot of money on it? You know, what happened here? Turns out that the out-of-pocket costs for Brazil to achieve this were, you know, less, equivalent to less than $5 a ton of averted carbon emissions, climate emissions. And those of you who play in climate world know that's really cheap, really, really, really cheap. And so it is affordable. And this decade-long decline in the deforestation rate, and nobody knows this, that Brazil is the country that has contributed more than any other country to reducing global climate emissions because they did this. So a couple of years ago when Obama said that the United States had done it, not true. It was Brazil. So how did Brazil do it? This is the result of a meta-analysis that my co-author and another colleague did, taking a bunch of studies, all the studies that they could find that looked at the correlation between or the association between forest condition, forest cover, and various factors. And the way this chart works is that in all these articles, you know, a bar over here is that a particular thing was 10 times more likely to be associated with less deforestation than more deforestation. Or the bars on this side, you know, these are, you know, the number of articles that show that this thing was, you know, 9 times more likely to be associated with more deforestation than less deforestation. And what's interesting is that, you know, some of them are things that, you know, you would, you know, predict. It's like, okay, closer to roads, nearer to a city, greater population, you know, more deforestation, and more law enforcement, less deforestation. Okay. So what Brazil did is actually very consistent with a lot of these broader findings. So law enforcement. Yeah, actually law enforcement works. You know, when you impound the cattle from the recently deforested, you know, pasture land, gets people's attention. Brazil also did things like establish protected areas to, you know, provide a buffer around the deforestation frontier. Indigenous peoples turn out to be very important in protecting the forest, and Brazil established indigenous territories to help shore up the indigenous people stewardship role. Rural income support, in other words, like access to credit, actually is often associated with deforestation. So Brazil constrained access to credit for the high deforestation municipalities. So Brazil did a lot of these things, and it shows that they work. Now, our book is not about how to stop deforestation, and Brazil is the only case study that we went into on these kinds of issues. But the point is that it is feasible. It can be done. It was done. And we know a lot about the kinds of policy tools that can be pulled to do it. One of the tricks to Brazil's success that's now available to everyone is mobilizing remote sensing technology to be able to detect where deforestation is happening in near real time. And one of the things that we devote a whole chapter of the book to is this revolution in remote sensing technology that has, you know, continues. I was talking to somebody before that, you know, is going so fast that if you blink, there's a whole new, you know, remote sensing technology that's even finer, you know, resolution and quicker, you know, in the turnaround. You can't keep up with it. At World Resources Institute, we have a platform called Global Forest Watch, where you too can just go online and see, you know, where deforestation is happening this week. This is actually a scene from Peru, and the pink dots are the so-called GLAD alerts, you know, using Landsat and other satellite images to, you know, alert where likely deforestation events are happening. What Brazil did is connect this kind of imagery to law enforcement effort. So you can actually say, okay, well, deforestation is going here. Let's deploy, you know, and do it. And so now other countries are following suit. So this technology not only allows rapid response to do something about deforestation, but it also allows you to do other things. This is a new tool that's just coming online called TRAES. And what they do is combine data sets that show like where that deforestation is happening with proprietary data sets about trade flows, like where stuff is loaded onto ports and customs information and tax information, so that you can click on particular municipalities in Brazil and show which trader, or you say, where does Bunge get its soy? Well, you can click on Bunge, find out the municipalities, find out who's the exporter, who's the importer, and on this side, I didn't fit it on the slide, but you know what's the destination country? So now, if you're Walmart and you want to know, you know, the soy that you're sourcing, is there a risk of it being associated with deforestation? You can, you know, just a couple clicks away, you can find out. And they're in the process of applying this now to palm oil in Indonesia. And so it's a whole new level of transparency about these, how these global commodity supply chains are affecting deforestation. Third thing that technology allows us to do is actually quantify the climate impacts of this deforestation more precisely. And so this is some work done by scientists at Woods Hole to estimate with more precision the carbon density of forests so that you can do these calculations for crediting in a global climate scheme about, you know, how much carbon is being either released or conserved in particular pieces of real estate. So, second key point about why now is that global norms are starting to shift in ways that are more favorable to protecting the forests. Let me give you just three quick examples. One is that, you know, it used to be that illegal logging is just kind of a fact of life. It's like, oh, well, you know, it's all corrupt and, you know, it's like drugs. You just can't, it's so lucrative, you can't get the, you know, can't stop it. But actually, over the last 10 years, there's been kind of a sea change where now it's like, no, it's not okay anymore. And so you get like a bust of, you know, lumber liquidators or somebody being caught, you know, trading in illegal lumber under the Lacey Act here in the United States. But it's a global phenomenon. And so this, for example, is a handshake between the president of Indonesia and the president of the European Commission, the first ever voluntary partnership agreement under this European program called FLEGTI, the Forest Law Enforcement, Governance, and Trade Initiative, in which Indonesia's system for certifying legal timber is recognized by the European Union so that they can freely have a license to export into the EU. So these kinds of agreements are gradually infiltrating the global trading system. Second norm change is increasing expectations for corporate responsibility in this realm. This is Paul Polman, who's the CEO of Unilever, and he's credited with being one of the leaders of this through something called the Consumer Goods Forum, to just start making commitments that, you know what, we're going to get deforestation out of our global supply chains. And the companies that whose logos you see here, as well as something like 400 more of them, have now taken on commitments to say, you know, by a certain date, we're going to stop, you know, sourcing from areas that are actively deforesting. And so, as I'll talk about in a minute, the deadline for doing a lot of this is 2020. And a lot of people starting to get nervous that that deadline's coming up soon and they aren't done yet. But they're scrambling to trace their supply chains and try to figure out how to manage, you know, third-party suppliers to make sure that their supply chains are clean. Third thing that's quite significant is a sea change in the norms about indigenous peoples. It's hard to kind of remember that, you know, 25 years ago when I was working in Indonesia, I mean, you really could be labeled as subversive if you championed indigenous people's rights. I mean, this was just not something that you could do. Brazil, once again, was ahead of the game and was, you know, recognizing indigenous communities and indigenous territories as part of that policy set of policy initiatives in the early 2000s. But now we have the UN Convention on the UNDRIP, UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. that was endorsed 10 years ago, and gradually a lot of international instruments are starting to recognize the role of indigenous peoples. And now, even in Indonesia, the president has recognized two tranches of indigenous territories from within the forest estate. And for somebody who worked in Indonesia 25 years ago, so that's like, that's amazing. And it's like a miracle. So things are moving in the right direction. And the last point on this is that we actually have achieved global consensus not only on the goals that we're trying to reach, like get deforestation out of the supply chains by 2020, but also the means on how to achieve them. And so there's been this whole series of sort of global commitment moments, you know? So like in 2011, there's the Bonn Challenge that was sort of led by the German government and, you know, getting governments to commit to, you know, hundreds of millions of hectares of forest that they're going to reforest or restore. The Tropical Forest Alliance 2020 was a club bringing together governments and companies and civil society to all say, how are we going to work together to get the deforestation out of commodity supply chains? We got in 2014, the UN, a climate summit in New York, and one of the outcomes of that summit was something called the New York Declaration on Forests, which has just been institutionalized into a platform at UNDP just a couple of months ago. And that brings together the governments, NGOs, indigenous peoples, companies, all saying, you know, we're going to have tropical deforestation by 2020 and eradicate it completely by 2030. And there are now, you know, annual reports on how are we doing on that. So there's all this infrastructure to get this going. Personally, I think the most important one could and should be the Paris Agreement, concluded, of course, at the end of 2015. And few people know that forest is like one of the only sectors that got its own place in the agreement itself. So Article 5 of the Paris Agreement is all about forests. And basically what it does is incorporate by reference 10 years of arduous negotiation on how do we do international cooperation on tropical forests. And basically what it's about is this thing called reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, or REDD+. And it's a conceptually simple but devil in the details system in which you set a baseline of, you know, your historical level of deforestation, for example. And if you as a country are able to reduce emissions below that level, the international community will compensate you for that difference. And so it is a payment for performance system. You know, for every ton of carbon below, you know, what would otherwise have happened, we will pay. Conceptually very attractive. For a cheaper source of emission reductions for rich countries, new source of development finance for developing countries. It was one of the most attractive pieces of the whole climate negotiation. What's happened? Well, the bad news is that because we don't have global carbon markets to generate the big bucks, and the financing available for this has been limited to development aid budgets, we've ended up with about $1 billion a year, which frankly is chump change and compared to what you can make by planting palm oil in the peat swamp. And so this was, you know, a quick toting up of where we were on financing as of the time of the Paris Agreement. And you can see that, you know, it's only, you know, it's less than $10 billion. And even of that, only a minority of it was on a payment for performance basis. So the rest of it was sort of traditional development assistance paid for the input side. So not a really big carrot or pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for successful performance. Some updates. Well, okay, we have to admit that the deforestation rate in Brazil has been ticking up over the last couple years, but it's only a little bit up compared to the historic highs back, you know, 14 years ago. So yes, while it's been going up, it's still much lower than it was before. And, you know, let's be frank, in the middle of a political and an economic crisis where budgets for law enforcement have been cut, for example, this is probably not altogether unexpected, and it doesn't disprove the policy tools that we talked about that have been shown to work if you actually apply them. As I mentioned before, there's something like 450 companies that are involved in either the palm oil, pulp and paper, beef or soy supply chains that have taken on these no deforestation commitments, and the 2020 deadline is approaching quickly. REDD financing mechanisms, and there are financing mechanisms at the World Bank, a new one at the Green Climate Fund, some bilateral sources of fund, a potential source of finance from the International Civil Aviation Organization that's setting up a market-based mechanism to offset aviation emissions, potentially including international forest offsets in the California cap and trade system, All these are tantalizingly out there. Very few of them have resulted in any cash on the line for developing countries, but they are inching forward. We can talk about those if you're interested. And I will just conclude with a metaphor that I borrowed from Giacomo Grassi, who used it in Bonn last December. Tropical forests are the Cinderella of climate change world. Because, you know, Cinderella, she's kind of neglected, but it's even a better analogy than that. Because why is she called Cinderella? She cleans up the ashes in the fireplace, right? So, you know, in the same way that forests pull carbon emissions from fossil fuels out of the air, she's cleaning up the climate for us. Yeah, tropical forests do that, and yet she's underappreciated and neglected and not invited to the ball, right? You know, very little media attention, very little finance. So the Cinderella, I'm going to write a blog about this next month for the International Day of Forests. Keep an eye out. So I hope I've convinced you that tropical forests are important to climate and development, and that now is time to do something about it. We in rich countries have a particular responsibility for doing that. Just remind you once again how cool tropical forests are. And end by saying the book, you can buy it if you want a physical copy, but you can also download it for free on the Center for Global Development website. And now I very much look forward to a discussion, and especially for those of you who have relevant expertise to identify yourselves and share it with all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Frances. So I think we'll just go right ahead and launch into some questions and discussions, because I know there are people in the room with various expertise. So we'll start here.
My name is Claribel Santiago. I'm not an expert, but have you looked into giving like a generation for the locals to go back to that section of the forest to use it for their economy, and then put like a sanction on it, and like the government will say, okay, you can't go back to that forest until, let's say, 25 years. And then they could go, like, use another part of the forest in that way. You know what I mean? So at least they still have a job. So how do they keep jobs? How do they have jobs if that's all they have?
Right. No. Great question. It's one that our book actually doesn't try to answer, because it is in the realm of domestic policy for how governments want to organize themselves to achieve this objective. But there's a huge universe of research out there about how various attempts to work with communities to sustainably manage forests can work. We do have a chapter in the book on, for example, various ways that people have tried to monetize the values of standing forests, whether it's markets for non-timber forest products, or ecotourism, or, you know, payments for environmental services from downstream municipalities. And, you know, there are circumstances under which all of those can work, but the argument is that they're often not generally applicable. They're not, you know, not something that you can do everywhere, and that putting a price on the carbon sequestration value of a forest may be different, because it is potentially a global market. And one that would be a reliable over time if we were to get to, you know, a regime, even at the national level, it doesn't have to be global, but to consistently reward people whose forests are sequestering carbon for all the rest of us. So I don't think there's any single right answer, but there are, you know, economic tools that can be brought to bear, because you don't have to, like, stay away from the forest, right? There are ways to make standing forests, you know, generate income. But without paying for either recognizing those goods and services that I talked about or paying for them, usually the economically rational thing to do is clear the forest and convert it to something else. But from a societal perspective, that's often a very bad idea.
I'm Rich Rosen, and I work pretty much full-time on climate change mitigation. So I was very pleased to hear your figure of 24% to 30% as a possibility for contribution towards mitigation. Can you paint for us a picture, though, of what the world would look like in, say, roughly, say, 20 years? If you pursued that 24% to 30%, how much more of the world would be forested compared to what's forested now? And would that additional forest then impinge on agriculture land? And would that have a negative impact on our ability to feed the world at that point in time, say roughly 20 years from now?
Yeah, it's a fabulous question, and I don't have numbers at my fingertips, but I can point you to a couple of recent papers that actually, you know, play those out. One is Bronson Griscom et al. He's a scientist at the Nature Conservancy, and they put out a paper just a few months ago on a sort of bottom-up calculations about, you know, how you get to that 30%. And you can, you know, peel it apart and get to the assumptions and question them about, like, how likely is it that we're all going to give up eating beef, you know, because that's part of the answer is, you know, getting rid of what Lord Stern called the lonely cow syndrome, you know, where you have, you know, one cow per hectare in a very inefficient agriculture and pulling back from some of the pasture land and reforesting, you know, some of those areas. There are questions about where you know, what the margins are, and I guess there are just too many variables in play that have to do with what your expectations are for the productivity, increasing productivity on currently cultivated area, as well as changes in diets, and how much of that productivity is going to go off to uses like the biofuels, you know, or not. So the ranges are huge, and in fact, one of my frustrations in that paper and another one by a group called Climate Focus, the paper is Stephanie Rowe et al., is some of the uncertainty bars for things like how much you could sequester through reforestation and restoration are huge. And it's also, the answer depends on what kind of economic constraint you're putting on it. Because there's lots of potential for reforestation, but reforestation can get expensive depending on the quality of the land you're trying to reforest or whatever, versus protecting the forests we already have, which I'm always eager to say, let's do that first, you know, because it's often the most straightforward, the lowest hanging fruit. So anyway, I'm managing to tap dance around actually answering your question, but those are two papers that put some specific numbers on the potential.
I'm Maggie Collins. I'm associated with the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. And I wonder if you can talk about the corporations that are making pledges to improve the supply chains and what actual pledges are they making and how is that going to be monitored?
Great question. This is all brand new. Some of the first pledges came just, about within the last 10 years or so. We tell the story in the book about the Greenpeace video that went viral, and it showed, I don't know if anybody's ever seen it, but you should Google it because it's worth watching. It's a one-minute video where this guy, he's kind of a bored office worker, and he opens up his Kit Kat, candy bar, and he starts chewing on it, and blood just spatters down his face and onto his keyboard. And he doesn't realize that his Kit Kat candy bar is actually the finger of an orangutan. And so the point is made that, the palm oil in the candy bar comes at the expense of, the tropical rainforest. But anyway, as a result of that viral campaign, Nestle was one of the first companies to come around and say, okay, we get it. We're going to deal with this issue. And then that was in 2006, and it really wasn't until 2013 in the aftermath of one of the periodic Indonesian forest fires that, was so bad it, closed the Singapore airport or something, with the haze, that this commodity trader called Wilmar made what was sort of the first high quality, it was called NDPE, no deforestation, no peat, no exploitation. So it's a package of commitments to no longer source from recently deforested areas, to no longer source from peatlands that were being disturbed. And the no exploitation part is a bundle of social related things like, free, prior, and informed consent for indigenous communities that were affected and respecting labor rights and stuff like that. So I use deforestation as a shorthand, but actually the commitments are a broader package of things. The different policies are differing degrees of precision, and some of them are linked to time-bound, implementation plans. Other ones are just sort of stated policies. But there's a whole industry now in the nonprofit community of doing just that, tracking the commitments. And so there's a website run by Forest Trends that's called Supply Change, and they keep track of these corporate commitments. And as I mentioned, there's a annual assessment of progress towards meeting the goals of that New York Declaration on Forests, and it's sort of a roving spotlight. There's like 10 goals in the Declaration, and every year they'll look at one or two goals. And the report in 2016 looked at progress on the commodity supply chain commitments. The most recent report particularly focused on financing. And so those are produced by a consortium of non-governmental organizations, but the reports are posted on the website of this new global platform at UNDP on the New York Declaration on Forests. So there's actually a lot of information out there about the sort of the state of play. And it's, you know, it's kind of like glass half full, glass half empty. I mean, there's some companies that are really, you know, trying. There are quite a number of others that have made commitments but then have gone radio silent, you know, and they haven't really, you know, been transparent about what they're doing or how far along. And frankly speaking, those who have tried to find an association between the commitments and actual decreases in deforestation are coming up empty. There doesn't seem to be a lot of, you know, discernible impact yet. Is that because they're not actually being implemented? Is that because of leakage? Is that because any forests that are protected by the good guys are immediately grabbed by the bad guys? You know, these are all things that are a current subject of study.
So I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
Let's all thank Frances for a really interesting talk.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Frances Seymour, Distinguished Senior Fellow at the World Resources Institute. Ms. Seymour's lecture was titled Why Forests, Why Now? The Science, Economics, and Politics of Tropical Forests and Climate Change. It was presented by the Boston University Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. Tonight's moderator was Pardee Center Associate Director Cynthia Barraquette. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.